It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio none other than Fire Chief McNutt. Welcome, Chief.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
Doing well.
We've been talking just prior to starting this interview about the fact that you have been making sure that the rest of the world is safe. So you went to Florida for a little bit.
That's correct. I was down there for about a week and a half.
Was it purely a vacation, or did you do any kind of...
80% vacation, 20% helping family with odd jobs around the house.
Okay. All right. While you were gone, there were a number of incidents here in Anchorage recently that involved fires, some very significant fires, and perhaps some of them had occurred prior to you leaving. An involvement of an apartment building?
That actually happened after I had already left.
Okay. And we all pay attention to them. Especially because there was a death involved and a number of people were injured. And it was a unlike situation, although we have multi-stories here in Palmer. There are far more tall buildings in Anchorage. And I know that one of the concerns that was raised there was about people, once they discovered, made aware there was a fire, actually leapt out of the building.
Correct. I did read something about that.
And there were some injuries associated with it and the rest of it. In your experience, how do you handle that? The fire is going, there are people in the second story or higher. Where are we in the city of Palmer regarding that kind of thing? Should that happen in one of our tall buildings?
Well, luckily, we don't have any buildings any higher than about three stories here in Palmer.
Okay.
Our ground ladders that we can pull off and put up by hand will reach those buildings, as well as the aerial apparatus we have, which I found out this morning, the new one, it will be on the barge in Seattle this morning. So should be here next week sometime.
Oh, all right.
Our plan is to have it on display at the Fred Meyer grand opening.
Oh.
So everybody should have a chance to see it there. But going back to the access issue, we do have the ground ladders. The personnel do training on how to set them up and place them for rescues or firefighting applications, depending on what's needed.
Right.
We practice those throughout the year. So the personnel are very, very good with that. But that's one of those skills. If you don't keep practicing, you will lose it. So that's why we have our training nights.
Right. And my sense about it was, once again, this, and I'm only picking up pieces of it. You probably will get more detail around all of it, of what happened there or... But it all began with a fire, of course, and apparently a lack of, the question was how were people alerted to there being a fire?
I haven't had a chance to read the entire story yet, but normally what happens in this case where there was lack of warning is either malfunctioning or just absence of smoke alarms in the structures.
Right.
And when I say malfunctioning, it can be anywhere from they're old, out of date, they just don't work properly, to the batteries have been removed for something else, or the batteries are just bad in the detector and have never been changed.
Yeah.
So those are usually the top reasons that the notification is behind, was because some type of smoke alarm issue.
And there was a discussion that was interesting about the fact that this was a relatively large building. It did not have a sprinkler system installed, although it met all the requirements. Apparently, new buildings would require a sprinkler system. Older buildings have been grandfathered in. They meet certain other requirements, and this one apparently met those requirements, but you still had a fire begin, and there we go.
Correct. For the building codes, of course, as times change, so do the codes. There was a time when large structures were not required to have sprinkler systems. So depending on when this building was built, it probably met the code at the time. And you do not, until you do some type of major renovation to a building, as long as it's still intact, it can still function for the rest of its life, meeting the code that it was built to.
Right.
Now, some places do choose to upgrade and have sprinkler systems installed later.
Right.
But not everybody does. And unfortunately, some of the problems are deaths and the fire spread, and sprinkler systems are a lifesaver.
Yeah. There was a second incident that also involved, in this case, carbon monoxide. That one seemed particularly troublesome. Again, this was a single family, but a large number of people in that family. And apparently the last report I saw was there was a heating system, I think in the garage, that malfunctioned in some way, but the level of carbon monoxide in the home was extraordinarily high, something like 1,000 versus something that might be 3 in that scale of reference would
right.
expect it.
Yeah, any level is not good, but there are thresholds that you can go up to without major problems. One of them, it sounds like in this home, was rising rapidly with no escape.
Right.
Usually that either means it's a malfunctioning piece of equipment. This time of year, it can also be, we've had problems with blocked vents.
Right.
If they have low vents, the snow piles up and it creates a dam, I guess, for lack of a better word, and holds the exhaust in because the exhaust is going to travel the least resistive path. And if that's back inside and not out through the hard packed snow, it's going to stay inside the residence.
So now we can bring from those two unfortunate events a look to our own situation here. We have over the last couple of years become used to not having a lot of snow. And this year in particular, I've noted that's easy. I have to move a little bit of it. There's snow that's rising, and the vent issue is kind of interesting. I just realized as you were talking, although I said, yeah, that's an important thing. And I remember reading about that. When I go home today, I have to go because we have a vent.
That's low.
That's low. And I realize I haven't taken a look at that.
Yeah, we've had a few incidents over my years here in Palmer where we've had to respond for a CO alarm. We get there, we start investigating, and sure enough, we do find levels. So one of the first things I do now, especially in the wintertime with snow levels, is send one of the guys around the house, look for the vents. If it's buried, uncover it, and right. we'll reevaluate. And we've had a few.
Okay. So now one of the other types of heating I know involves space heaters. We just had one improved, in fact, a new one put into our garage, which is not heated with the system in the house. And in that process, there's a very simple exhaust, flexible hose, actually, that goes up. And this one's high. It's not going to be a problem. Snow's going to get that high, I do not believe. But what I do notice that sometimes what forms up there is a beard of ice that hangs down. And I've wondered from time to time whether those systems the exhaust obviously have some moisture, but do they ever block up that way?
They will. The ice can dam up just like the snow can and cause the exhaust to close off. So it's one of those you need to check periodically. And if you have to figure out a way to tap away that ice or break away that ice to make sure that your equipment is venting like it should so you don't get that backup.
Right. Well, now I have a couple things to look at, just realize. But that's and especially when we have this kind of crazy weather, which gets very cold and then warm and cold and warm with kind of a melting and the rest of that happening.
Right. Then that causes us a problem with the auto accidents on the road. As you probably heard over the past few weeks, and I did as well, was the ice buildup on the road and mm-hmm. causing the vehicles to slide.
Yeah.
So there's always something going on with winter weather that keeps us on our toes.
Okay. Well, so let's segue from this discussion, which is, I think, very important, at least for me, and I hope for other listeners. You mentioned a new piece of equipment coming in, and it'll be on display. We're only days away from what has been predicted to be the opening of the new Fred Meyer store. And so this new piece of equipment will be on display there, you say?
Correct. Our new 101-foot aerial apparatus, a platform truck, we've been working on for quite a while now. And I got a confirmation today it was on its way to Seattle to make the trip up to Alaska. So we should have it received next week.
Okay.
We can get it in, evaluate it, make sure everything's working properly and functioning. And then our goal is to have it on display for the public at the Fred Meyer grand opening.
So for those people who may not be familiar with equipment that's used with by fire departments, what's special about this rig?
This allows us to get to those high locations you were talking about earlier in the broadcast. It's got a mounted ladder with a platform on the end of it, mm-hmm. a truck, so we can reach up to 101 feet off
wow.
the ground.
Ooh.
It also allows us to use what we call elevated water streams. So if we have a fire that's high, say, for instance, on top of the new Fred Meyer, heaven forbid, they had a fire or something in one of their air conditioning units,
right.
could rise up with this ladder and get to the fire without having to try and access it through the inside of the building. So it gives us that quicker capability to effectively solve the problem.
Where will this be housed?
This will be housed in the downtown station right behind City Hall.
Okay.
Currently, there is a 1985 in there that we're using. And it will be going out of service, and this one will be taking its place and for here for years to come.
When equipment goes out of service, where does it go?
There's many options. One, a lot of sometimes is departments will put them into what they call reserve status. Other times, they are sold to other departments. Sometimes they are just sold off for parts. It all depends on the capabilities that the truck still has left. For us on this older truck, it's run a good life. It's over almost 32 years old now.
Wow.
So it's one of those parts are getting hard to find.
Okay.
It's not the most technologically advanced truck. Of course, technology increases, safety increases, so this is an older style vehicle. So more than likely, this one will either get sold out to a smaller department that needs something,
mm-hmm.
or it will be used for a parts vehicle for another department that has one that still they're planning on using for many years, and they could piece things off of this.
Okay. One of the things that has been under discussion for a long time, before you went off and now that you're back, it's still finishing up and particularly focused over at the Borough Assembly, has to do with changes in the dispatch service, mm-hmm. 911, et cetera. I'm just curious, I realized, how will that change affect the Palmer Fire Department?
Right now, that's something that we are currently working on to figure out how that's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
The city of Palmer, of course, is dispatched by the police department.
Right.
So we will be sticking with that. Where we're in works right now is the area that we cover outside the city boundaries. We're still trying to figure out how best to make that function because it's a contracted area.
Chief McNutt, I'm Mike Malevsky here. We're dealing with inside the city, and we're talking about some things associated with firefighting and communication. My mentioned reminded myself and listeners that there are arrangements so that if you need help in the city or need help out, or someone outside the city needs help, you get to do that. But with this kind of change in the dispatch, how that is going to work sounds like it's still requiring a little bit of work.
It's still requiring a little bit of work. Like I was saying before, we have what we call the Greater Palmer Fire Service Area, which is a fire service area outside the city of Palmer. That has been contracted to the city of Palmer since sometime in the 70s, I believe about early 70s.
Okay.
So it's been in place for many, many years, works wonderfully, as you can tell by all the years that it's been going on. But since that is outside the city limits, we're going to have to work on communications for that location, whether it'll be through the new dispatch center or possibly remain with the city of Palmer, since we are the department that covers that area.
Okay.
So there's still some work to be done.
So just to sum up for listeners and from what I've been able to follow and observing the assembly talk about these things, the city of Palmer will retain a dispatch capability for its own department and, as you say, the fire department.
Correct.
Okay. When we talk about dispatch, there's one part of the communication that happens. I pick up my phone and dial 911, push a button and automatically dials. And I'm connected to the dispatch center. You, however, as you go out about your work, I have to communicate amongst the members of the fire department and the police department, et cetera. What's the state of the radio communication that you have at the present time?
It functions very well. I pick up my radio, I press the button, kind of like your cell phone, except right off the dial any numbers, and I talk. But I'm not talking to just a single individual. I'm talking to anybody else who's monitoring my radio channel.
Okay.
So it's still working.
Okay.
It'll, of course, like everything, it will be needing some upgrades, but it still functions right now and does us very well.
Okay. Well, good. And of course, once again, my sense is that the majority of fire calls are within the city of Palmer.
It kind of splits from year to year. Some years it'll be in more inside the city. Some years it'll be more outside the city.
Really? Okay.
Yes. So it's excuse me. It does depend on from year to year. This past year, 2016, we had 574 calls for service is what we ended up with. The year before that, we had 778.
Oh.
So we had a big decrease. Of course, a lot of that was due to the Sockeye fire in 2015, which kept everybody on their toes in 2016. So we had way less wildland fire calls. People were much safer. They were paying attention, which is normal. If you look back through the histories, you can kind of tell when there was a large event, and then the next year after that, our call volume will go down.
And then it'll kind of build,
and then there's a large event, and the call volume will go down.
Okay.
I believe it was before my time, but 2003, they had that large wildland wintertime event here.
Yes.
And if you look at our 2004 calls, the numbers went down some. And then five, they went down a little bit, and then they started climbing again.
Okay, so I know that the department's been involved with it, even other than the fact that we have some large events and people's attention is drawn to it. You have an ongoing education program with people to help understand what can be done, whether it's digging a vent out of the snow or one thing or another to prevent that. What kinds of things is the department involved with right now?
We have multiple different things. A lot of it's based on the community's needs and they contact us for. Just recently, we did a safety fair at Job Corps where we talked about fire safety to people that visited the inside table. All the way out to, we had our fire extinguisher trainer set up outside, and the students and staff were able to come over and actually use a pressurized water extinguisher to put out a simulated fire, which most of the public never ever uses a fire extinguisher in their life.
Sure.
It's something good to know. So we have that capability. We do lots of children's classes, whether they come visit us at the fire station or we go to the schools and talk about fire safety. I have some firefighters that's one of the major functions they do for me. They really enjoy it. They like it. We just had a little class yesterday of about six children from a preschool that came by the station, and they did a tour of the station and talked about the tools and then how to be safe and how to do things. And so that's worked really well. I've done visits to care centers, schools again. We do the booth inspections at the Alaska State Fair.
Right.
Every year the fair happens, there's many booths that need to be inspected for fire safety. So we get together as a group and go out and try and knock out as many of those as we can, as fast as we can. But we want to make sure that the fair is safe so that it's a safe event for everybody.
Right.
And so there are multiple things out there. The biggest thing is we need to know, contact us, and we can work on scheduling something to fit your needs.
Okay. So I came across a very interesting article, and I actually covered it earlier this week. And maybe you're familiar with this, and since you mentioned working with kids. In Germany, there's been over a number of years, a program where teachers have been trained, some 2,000 teachers in Germany, to work with kids in what was described as a different way than we do here in the United States. In other words, a 6 or 7 year old was shown how to properly use a match to light. This is kind of an interesting thing because it's been in place for many years now, and the results seem to be coming that there have been no instances reported in the record of any student who's gone through the program being involved in a fire. But what happens is that students are instructed how to light the match, how to put the match out, how to light a candle, etc., with the idea that if you do it safely, you are also taking away this kind of don't do it forbidden thing. And the contrast was referred to in the United States in general. There has been an approach that says, don't touch a match.
Right.
But if that's the case, then when do you learn how to use a match?
That's the first I've ever heard of that. So I don't really have a good answer for you on that one or not.
Okay. So I'm going to toss this out as it was a New York Times article, and you'll be able to find it quite clearly. And you have your own resources and approaches. But I'd be curious to explore what that means there, and whether there is some value, and whether, I don't know, whether the Fire Chiefs Association of the United States or whatever, but there seems to be a cultural thing that had developed that says one approach to ensuring that there we fire safety is not to have kids touch matches, stay away from them, versus another approach which says, well, how do you proactively help people and take away whatever is kind of a seducing, forbidden thing that people will try to do because they...
Right. Yeah. I know one of the things that I've done in the past is of course, we do a lot of the same thing where it's don't touch it, leave it, let an adult take care of it. But I've demonstrated the dangers it can cause.
Oh, sure.
And I think that's one of the big things is if you can do that, because I, of course, have three children of my own, and I can remember when they finally made their teen years, I did let them work a match. I figured this is one of those skills that we were on a campground.
Sure.
Needed to start a fire, safe environment. I could monitor what they were doing, but I showed them how to do it. Now, of course, when they were little children, I didn't do that at all. So, yeah, this is an interesting thing you brought up.
I'm going to file that away, and when you come back next time, let's talk about it, because it just struck me, slightly different culture, et cetera, and approach, but there seemed to make, it sort of made sense, and I had never thought about that in the past, except that I now think back to my four kids and saying, yes, I remember having them learn how to safely light a candle when they were relatively young, and that seemed to be good thing, and none of them have been involved in fires. So,
and of course, for my children, growing up with a firefighter dad, certain like candles. I won't let them use candles in the house.
There's no candles allowed in my house. Yeah,
because of the danger of the fire.
And that's a valid approach. And and all the rest of that. So for them,
their friends would ask about matches, but my three, of course, those are bad. Dad says they're bad. So we never had that problem when they were small.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. We've come pretty much toward the end here. Have we missed anything? I've brought up a number of topics. Anything that you'd like to leave listeners with before we finish?
You've talked mostly about it, and I know I bring them up every time I'm here, but because I feel that they are that important, check those batteries, check your detectors. We just had the carbon monoxide death and the fire death.
Right.
It's good reminders. Time change is going to be coming here shortly, and change your clocks, change your batteries. Pull them down, clean them off, check the dates. There are dates on the back of them. If they're anywhere, we usually recommend 7 years old or older, get rid of them and replace them with new ones. They will malfunction. But that's the best way to protect yourself is to have those warning devices in place. And when they do go off, don't treat them as just a nuestance. Investigate.
Sure.
Doesn't mean you have to call us right away.
Right.
Sometimes it's nothing more than the unit telling you that it's a low battery. It just needs to have the battery checked out. But there are directions on the back of the newer ones, anything that's over 7 years old that should be gone by now. So everything should have directions on it. But read those directions. Sometimes it's just a matter of it's one beep every minute or 30 seconds, and that's telling you the battery's bad and needs to be changed.
Okay.
But investigate. Don't just pawn it off as a problem, and then the outcome is not what you want.
Well, that adds another thing to my list to do today when I go home to make sure I've checked all of those. Thank you very much, Chief McNutt, for coming in for another fascinating discussion about what's happening inside the city, in this case with the fire department. Have a good day.
Thank you.